This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Sex and teenagers is a difficult subject for many parents, nerve-wracking for most teens, and a dilemma for the law. Case in point, Gennaro Wilson, a young man in Georgia, sentenced to 10 years in prison for having oral sex with a 15-year-old girl when he was 17. The jury gasped when they heard that sentence, handed down by a judge who, under the law, had no alternative. The sentence was thrown out by another judge yesterday. We're going to have an update for you in a few moments. That case and others raise questions about the age of consent, about statutory rape, about why some kinds of sex can be more severely punished than others, about who belongs on sexual predator lists, and about the application of these laws. Later in the program, a video shootout inside England's Manchester Cathedral sets off a battle royal, and your emails. But first, sex and teenagers. Where should we set the age of consent? How do we define statutory rape? Should we leave room for exceptions? We want to hear from parents and young adults. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can join this conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Jeremy Redman, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He joins us on the phone from the Douglas County Courthouse in Douglasville, Georgia. Nice to have you on the program today. Jeremy Redman, are you there? One more time. We're trying to reach Jeremy Redman, the reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, with us from the Douglas County Courthouse in Douglasville, Georgia. Jeremy, can you hear us?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Would you do us the favor, take us back to the beginning here?
Certainly.
And I guess that's a videotape.
That's right. Gennaro Wilson and some friends had rented some hotel rooms in Douglasville, a town just west of Atlanta, to have a New Year's Eve party. It was 2003, and they had several girls over for a visit, and a friend videotaped what happened that night. And the videotape shows Gennaro Wilson having intercourse with a 17-year-old girl and receiving oral sex from a 15-year-old girl. During the case, the video was used as evidence. And it was also came out during the case that at the party, General Wilson had been smoking marijuana and drinking alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So the videotape was key to this case.
And as I understand, many of the other kids who were shown on the tape decided to take a plea.
All of them did, with the exception of General Wilson.
So when he went to trial, what was he charged with?
He was charged with two crimes. One was raping the 17-year-old, of which he was acquitted of that crime. And the other was aggravated child molestation of the 15-year-old.
Aggravated child molestation?
Correct. A felony charge that results at the time in a minimum prison sentence of 10 years.
And this is, how did it get to be aggravated? This was, this young girl was consenting. It's not anything any of us would necessarily endorse, but nevertheless, this was not forced upon her.
The law at the time, called the Child Protection Act, was passed in 1995, and the Republican legislator who authored it said the intent of his bill was to crack down on dangerous sexual predators and not to lock up consenting teenagers in sex acts. So Matt Towery, that legislator, says that the law was misinterpreted, and it was actually amended during the session, he says, to raise the age of consent to 16 in the Senate at the time. And it passed, and as a result of that, Gennaro got caught up in this thing.
Mm-hmm. So he was sentenced to 10 years in prison. That prompted, well, first of all, we'll get to this in a minute. So that prompted an appeal, and that went to court yesterday.
The appeal was done last week. The judge ruled yesterday, granting the appeal, essentially that the sentence was cruel and unusual under the Constitution, and he voided the 10-year prison sentence, reduced the penalty from a felony to a misdemeanor, and ordered Gennaro Wilson freed from prison.
And
he remains in prison today.
And how long has he been in prison overall?
Over 2 years.
Over 2 years. Now, the prosecutor said he plans to appeal.
The attorney general in the case is actually stepped in representing the prison warden in the case where the appeal was filed in Forsyth, and is appealing that judge's ruling yesterday to the Georgia Supreme Court.
And so this could drag on for some time, and presumably Gennaro Wilson will remain in prison until the appeals are settled.
Presumably. The case with the appeal in the Georgia Supreme Court can take months. A bond hearing has been set to release Gennaro Wilson from prison pending the appeal for July 5th. So he's going to be in prison at least till July 5th.
Mm-hmm. Now, what seems to have happened in this case is Gennaro Wilson got caught up in a sort of limbo between two different pieces of legislation, two laws. The law that was passed subsequently is called the Romeo and Juliet exception. Would you explain that for us?
Yeah. Last year, recognizing Gennaro Wilson's case and the concern about teenagers caught in these situations ending up in prison, the legislature amended the law to make the act that Gennaro was involved in a misdemeanor punishable by only a year in prison.
And this could not be applied retroactively to his case, however.
That's what the Attorney General's office has been arguing all along, that this is not retroactive.
Now, Mr. Wilson became something of a cause celeb, politicians, reverends voicing their opinions that Gennaro should be set free.
Certainly. He's attracted national media attention, and he's had several big hitters go to bat for him, including President Jimmy Carter, wrote a letter just recently on behalf of him supporting his appeal.
And some of these supporters say this is a question, yes, there are muddy laws regarding the age of consent and who gets charged as what under these conditions, but they also say this is a case about race.
Certainly, it's been a big issue in this case, and the responses we've gotten to the story have been all over the map, people arguing that the prosecution was influenced by race, but also people arguing that if he were white, he would not receive this treatment or this granting of his appeal. But I might add that Gennaro and all the defendants in the case and all the victims in the case were African American, as is the attorney general, who's black. So you have people arguing on both sides of this situation.
Has the case been raised by Gennaro Wilson's supporters that this is how many, we may not like it, but how many 15, 16, 17-year-old kids are having sex and never get caught on videotape and therefore are never prosecuted? The selective prosecution.
Again, I don't know how much of a case the prosecutors would have had without the videotape. It would have probably been a he said, she said situation. But the defense attorneys for Gennaro Wilson are making, take great pains to point out that they don't condone teenage consensual sex, but point out that it's a fact of life.
Jeremy Redman, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Redman, a reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, with us from the Douglas County Courthouse in Douglasville, Georgia. With us now is B.J. Bernstein. She was Gennaro Wilson's appellate attorney. She's with us from Georgia Public Radio Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, and quite a roller coaster ride that Gennaro and I have been on.
I bet it's been quite an experience. We should mention, by the way, we've invited in Georgia's Attorney General Thurbert Baker to be with us today, and he declined the invitation. But as long as we have with you, just getting back to the point that Jeremy Redman made, apparently, at least according to the legislator who wrote this law, it was never intended for cases such as Gennaro Wilson's.
Precisely. I mean, this was a law that was put into place to deal with those adult sexual predators that we all fear that we have sex offender registries for. It was never meant to deal with teenage consensual contact. And in fact, if you'll remember a couple years ago, there was a case about Marcus Dixon, very similar young man, great grades from Rome, Georgia, star athlete, who was charged for 10 years in prison for an act of consensual sex. And his case was overturned. And in that case, I assisted with it a little bit. And the Supreme Court warned the legislature that this was going to happen, that the distinction between oral sex and intercourse was going to come back to haunt some teenager, and that teenager is Gennaro Wilson.
And we should point out that had he been convicted of having intercourse with this young woman, the penalty that he might have been subject to was considerably less than oral sex.
Precisely. It would have been a misdemeanor and no sex offender registry. I mean, literally, had he gotten the young woman pregnant, which I think everyone could have agreed that would have been even a worst case scenario here and probably done the most to alter everybody's life, had the least amount of possible criminal penalty. And so that was part of our argument when we went to the legislature to get a Romeo and Juliet provision across the board so that when teens engage in consensual acts, whatever sexual acts those are, that it's just a misdemeanor with no sex offender registry.
And sex offender registry, that played an important part in this case, too.
A huge part, because Georgia, just like many other states, constantly keeps expanding the scope of the registry. Here in Georgia, you can't live within 1,000 feet of a church, a school bus stop, a swimming pool. You can't work around children. You have some issues about even living with children in your household. In effect, certain entire regions of Georgia you can't live in. In fact, there's a huge federal lawsuit going on now with regard to the sex offender registry. Mm-hmm. And for someone like Gennaro, who really wants to go to college and really work with young people, because he's been through a lot to be able to tell them what it's really like to be in prison and to make some stupid mistakes at a party, he wouldn't be able to do that if we don't keep him off the registry.
Here's a statement we do have from the Attorney General's office. He said that there was a deal offered that would have allowed Gennaro Wilson to plead to first offender treatment, which would mean he would not have a criminal record, nor would he be subject to registering on the sex offender registry once his sentence had been completed. The plea deal, if accepted by his lawyers, could also result in Gennaro Wilson receiving a sentence substantially shorter than the 10-year mandatory minimum for which he was originally sentenced, possibly leading to his release based on time already served. It sounds like they're offering a pretty good deal.
Well, actually, when you examine it, it's not a good deal. This is the situation. When we were offered something, by the way, this is was offered on Friday before the decision on Monday. Remember, a court has now said this is a misdemeanor that carries no more than 12 months now.
Another court could change their mind.
They want Gennaro to plead to a felony. 15 years on probation. What first offender status says is after you complete the period of probation, then you are no longer considered a convicted felon. So they want him 15 years on probation. They want him a convicted felon for 15 years. There's some question about whether he would need to register while he's waiting for that 15 years to go by. And again, when you compare it to what the maximum could be now, which is 12 months, that offer, it sounds good in words, but in actions, it damages substantially Gennaro Wilson's future. And even if you think he did something wrong that night, and he admits that, you know, partying with his buddies like that was wrong, it doesn't deserve the 28 months he spent in prison and then another 15 years of government supervision.
We're talking about the legal issues that surround teens and sex and where we should set the age of consent. We'll look at what other states are doing and take your calls when we come back. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The case of Gennaro Wilson raised questions about the way the law handles teenagers and sex in Georgia and other states. We'll talk about where other states set the bar in a few minutes. Right now, BJ Bernstein is with us. She was Gennaro Wilson's appellate attorney. You're, of course, welcome to join the conversation. Where should we set the age of consent? How do we define statutory rape? Should we leave room for exceptions? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog, npr.org/blog of the nation. And here's an email we got from Daniel in Portland, Oregon. One relevant question I didn't hear raised regarding gender disparity. The young man was convicted. The girl was not charged. What if the girl had been 17 and the boy had been 15? Would she have been convicted and he held blameless?
She would have been convicted possibly at that point because she would have been the older one. She would have been an adult under Georgia law. At age 17, you are an adult for criminal purposes. So It could have been the other way around. But he's on to something there that usually it's the male that it's prosecuted and the female that is not. You know, our position in this has been that we don't want to see prosecution of the young woman. That's not the way to deal with the issue of teen sex, in our opinion.
Is the law... Sometimes the law does have to come into it. There do have to be lines established, though.
Well, certainly, and they have them. And, you know, as you just mentioned, most states, and although it's a surprise to most parents that teenage consensual contact is criminalized in most states, It's just usually a misdemeanor.
And some acts, as in this case in Georgia, oral sex is considered more serious than intercourse.
Right. That was based historically, actually, on old law that the only type of sexual relations that were appropriate were the type of sexual relations that result in a family or giving birth to a child in wedlock. And so all that law stems from that. So any other sexual act became illegal and then with time became more harshly treated.
Homosexual acts, are they treated more harshly as well?
No. I mean... Not under Georgia law. There's no distinction in terms of child molestation, whether it's a heterosexual act or a homosexual act, although I believe there is one or two states. I think recently, I'm trying to remember if it was Kansas. I apologize. But one, I know there was one state that tried to make that distinction on consensual, that you could have consensual teenage heterosexual sex, but not homosexual sex. I think that was struck down, though.
And as you look back on this, and obviously you've got some ways to go yet, but as you look back on where you've been thus far, where do you think you've learned about the criminal justice system and statutory rape laws?
Well, you know, I learned enough that actually I've started a nonprofit on the topic of just these laws and general the criminal laws that apply to young people. It's called myfifth.org, my5th.org. And on there, we use video and an interactive map that has listed. You can click on your state and see the age of consent for sex in your state, because I think part of the dialogue about teen sex has been missing the legal component, where parents or young people don't know what the law is. And in this case, the prosecutor had kept saying, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Mm-hmm. And yet, because of our fear of discussing sexuality, you know, we've severely cut back on sex education in schools because of all the moral issues and people's personal privacy issues at play. By not discussing it with kids, we put them in Gennaro Wilson's position, where they've done something that everybody else is doing, not realizing the full long-term consequences.
B.J. Bernstein, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
B.J. Bernstein, Gennaro Wilson's appellate attorney, founder of myfifth.org. That's a website where kids can go to find out what their rights are. You can click on a link to her site from our own blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And she was joining us today from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. With us now is Frank Zimmering, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, author of the book An American Travesty, Legal Responses to Adolescent Sexual Offending. He's with us from the Dwinell Hall Studio at UC Berkeley. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, sir.
And let's go back to what we were just talking about with B.J. Bernstein. Where do age of consent laws come from? What's their origin? And you know, why are they constructed the way they are?
Okay, I'll get there, but I want 30 seconds first to say that this particular case turns out to be a sort of a three-train train wreck of certain disastrous elements in modern criminal law. Statutory rape is a problem in any environment. But in the facts of this case, there are two other legal insanities that interact with the age of consent to produce a disaster. One of them is mandatory minimum prison terms. Mm-hmm. And the people who voted for those prison terms were thinking of repetitive pedophiles and not New Year's Eve party tapes. Mandatory minimum prison terms are almost always unfortunate. They're catastrophic here, and they make bad substantive law, such as the Georgia law on consent that we're going to get to, a lot worse. The second thing, which is just dreadful, is that many, if not most, teenage sex notification and registration laws treat teenagers who have sexual difficulties with the law as if they are confirmed adult offenders. For reasons of developmental psychology, for reasons of criminological wisdom, that's also nuts. So you have those two layers of criminal law nuttiness, and now you have this wonderful term, statutory rape. What is it? How does it come from? How does it get to play here? It's half historical peculiarity, and it's half legal fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The peculiarity historically is this. Not so many years ago, you were asking, what's the law on consulting adults, Neil?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the law's changed very dramatically in the last half century. 50 years ago, in almost every state in the union, anything that adults wanted to do sexually with other adults, if they weren't married to them, was illegal. If it wasn't with a spouse, then it was either adultery or fornication. If it was oral or anal sex, either heterosexual or homosexual, that was sodomy. And some of these tremendous felony penalties were available for adults, too.
Mm-hmm.
The world has changed for adult consent tremendously.
Well, let's get back to the age of consent and statutory rape, if you would.
No. But you see, we're tiptoeing up to that. It's very important that we understand first what the adult standard is. And adults now have constitutional rights. The last case by the U.S. Supreme Court was Lawrence versus Texas. Constitutional rights to sexual self-expression. Now the question is, well, why don't teenagers have those rights too? And here we get back to the legal distinction between consensual sex and forcible sex.
Mm-hmm.
The legal fiction that we're dealing with is this. The law has an age of consent that is based on the immaturity of individuals who are too young to decide whether or not they want to open a Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise or buy a used car or join the Army or get married or decide that they do or don't want to have sex.
Mm-hmm.
So the age of consent is literally the law saying at what age do we think kids are old enough to make informed judgments about whether or not it would be a good idea for them to have sexual relations. Now, there are two things that are involved in making that judgment. One of them is how we feel about kids' maturity, but the other is how we feel about kids' sexuality. And boy, are adults worried about kids' sexuality.
Indeed, but so, I think most of us can agree that there is an age below which any consent is not properly informed, that's a child and should be protected.
Well, in the first instance, there are ages below which the kids themselves are not sexual, and it's not merely that consent isn't properly informed. I think I was probably 36 before my judgments were properly informed. But there are kids who are not sexual players. But here's the problem. We'd like our kids to all be virgins at 19. So we imagine a world which is very different from the world that we live in, where the average onset of sexual intercourse is 16, the average onset of what is called heavy petting, which is the touching of genitals, mm-hmm. in consensual romantic relationships, is 14. And the problem is that we set the consent bar not only looking at the cognitive capacities of kids, but also looking at our own moral judgments. Now, about half the states in the union construct this legal curiosity statutory rape. The fiction is based on this. Since you don't have a capacity to consent, then any sexual conduct that you engage in must be regarded as the moral equivalent of force. If there's no consent, then it's obviously rape. Well, in fact, the world has more than two possibilities. There is always consensual behavior where the individual involved is too immature to have that consent fully remove that from mm-hmm. social concern. But that doesn't make it into forcible rape in any practical sense. So what a lot of states have been doing is coming up with a different penal theory for why underage sex should still be in the criminal law. And that penal theory is exploitation. And in these circumstances, it's not simply the age of the younger of the two people that's involved. It's the age difference.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with child molestation, if you don't look at how old the offender is that if two 15-year-olds have sex with each other, in many states, they're both child molesters. That's silly. In Georgia, one guesses if they were 15 years old, they might both get mandatory 10-year sentences. Who's being protected? How does that treat kids with the same moral standard that we use for adults? One answer to that question I have called in some writing on the subject the new mathematics of statutory rape. That is where a state law, and half the states do this, will say it can only be criminal is that if there's a 4 or 5 year difference between the age of the person who's being charged with the crime and the age of the person who is being viewed as a victim.
These are the so-called Romeo and Juliet laws.
Well, no, these are not necessarily Romeo and Juliet laws, because the Romeo and Juliet laws may make moral judgments about what is good sex versus bad sex and may not use age differences as a way of clearing out from the criminal justice system all these masses of cases.
And we're going to continue this lecture in just a moment and maybe even get in a call or two. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Our guest is Frank Zimmering, a law professor and Wolfen Distinguished Scholar at Bolt Law School at the University of California in Berkeley. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm just trying to get back to this controversy that we have here and these broader issues involved. There does have to be an age of consent somewhere, does there not?
Absolutely. But then the question is, do you use the criminal law to back it up? And if you do use the criminal law to back it up in that way, what do you do about enormous discretions? What I'm trying to push to is the fact that there are 10,000 of these acts that go unpunished for every act that gets punished when you have such a huge gap between what the law
So it's inherently
punishes.
Selective prosecution.
It inherently, that's right, and that means that it can't be principled.
And therefore it's open to abuse as well, as some of the people in this case have suggested.
Anything is abusive there because, you see, even if you were to pick the guilty party by lottery, the extraordinary difference between sending that party to jail for 10 years and letting everybody else develop normally is not the sort of thing that a civilized society should be able to live with.
Let's see if we get a caller on the line. This is Gary. Gary's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. I'm
sure.
A big fan. I'm just curious as to what the prosecutor's motives are. If the girl wasn't actually pressing charges, why would he be pursuing this case and wasting money on prosecuting basically a 17-year-old kid? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Gary, thanks very much. And I don't know how closely engaged you are in this particular case, Frank Zimmering, but it suggests to me the answer that one of the legislators gave when asked why he voted for a law that was less than perfect in the first place. He said, well, it's hard to vote against something called the Child Protection Act of 1995.
Okay, it is absolutely impossible to vote against things called that. And for that reason, this country has an epidemic of not problematic laws, but catastrophic laws. The registration and notification laws that every state in the union and federal legislation now focus on treat adolescent sex, in many cases consensual adolescent sex, in a way which is not, as I said, troublesome. It's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And it absolutely removes any moral force of the criminal law. Now, how can you have this kind of idiocy? Part of it is because we're so hung up ourselves, so worried about the sexual conduct of our adolescent children, that we want to imagine that acts which are fully consented to, that the kids want to do, aren't really consensual. And that's our problem as much as it's their problem. But when we start writing statute books based on a planet that nobody lives on, we're in serious trouble.
And let's see if we can get another caller on the line quickly. This is Rob. Rob with us from Boston.
Yeah, how you doing?
All right.
I'd like to talk about, I was actually arrested for what was called lewd and lascivious battery in the state of Florida. And I'd like to describe for a minute, if I could, what's happened to me since then. I was 20 years old, and I was arrested for having sex with a minor. They called it lewd and lascivious battery. It was 15. I went through a court process where I was fortunate enough where my parents were able to afford a lawyer, which I desperately needed to work out a deal where I served 3 years probation, no jail time, and had what was called withheld adjudication instead of a conviction.
Right.
I served 3 years probation in a counseling system, which was probably the most invasive and difficult thing I've ever done in my life. I would have two times a week I would need to go to group counseling. I had to take a lie detector test once every 2 months. And I had a series of other restrictions that pretty much meant I couldn't leave my house. You know, the whole not being able to live 1,000 feet within a school. And I couldn't find an apartment. I couldn't find anywhere to live. I basically had to move, you know, miles and miles away.
Rob, I'd hope to be able to get this in before the break, but we're going to have to pause. I'm going to leave you on hold, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold, and when we come back, we'll continue talking with Rob and with Frank Zimring, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, author of An American Travesty, Legal Responses to Adolescent Sexual Offending. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're talking about how the law handles issues of teens and sex and the questions it raises about the age of consent, punishment, and application of these laws. Our guest is Frank Zimring. He's a law professor and author of the book, An American Travesty, Legal Responses to Adolescent Sexual Offending. When we went to the break, Rob was with us. Rob calling us from Boston and describing a situation some years ago. He was arrested in Florida and for having sex with a 15-year-old girl and worked out a 3-year probation deal under which he was said he was subject to invasive tests, a lie detector test, that sort of thing, and was on a list where he was a sexual offender and unable to find an apartment, unable to get work. So, Rob, I'm sorry, pick up the story from there, if you would.
I just want to make two quick points about it. I was in the counseling. I was grouped. There was me and one other kid who was a year younger than me, and we were in there with about 9, 10 other people, all 30, 40, 50, 60 years old, and all of whom had, you know, spent 10, 15 years in prison for, you know, crimes against kids, you know, male, female, under the age of 10, 11, 9, 8, mm-hmm. all ages. And we were kind of grouped into these people. And the counseling, while it did do some good in my life and helped me through a lot of issues, I felt really wasn't geared towards me. It wasn't something that I really needed. I was, you know, in college and young, you know, partying, much like, you know, the person you're talking about on the
and then suddenly video. Grouped in with a bunch of much older pedophiles.
Yeah, and so now as a result, I have to be registered as a sex offender for the rest of my life. I cannot ever get off the list in any way. I've tried numerous avenues. And as the law is, I will have to stay registered as a sex offender till I die.
Hmm. And that, Frank Zimring, is a relatively new aspect of this. These lists of sexual predators, again, meant to protect small children from people who are, well, you know, they're unable to help themselves in some degree. But in any case, Rob and indeed some of these other people we're talking about just don't seem to be in the same category.
Well, they're not, and part of the problem is grouping adolescent offenders who are in a different developmental stage and who, even if they're involved with younger children, because the police sometimes discretionarily will simply turn their heads when they see consensual same-age sex.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but these people are lumped in with pedophiles. And the reason this happens is that nobody is spending more than 35 seconds writing on the back of a napkin the categories that become lifetime legislation. Part of this is a failure of the political process. Brave governors are a vanishing breed in the United States. And the moral panic around sexual offending in the United States has created a situation where you cannot have a sensible public discussion in any branch of government. Now, for people who hate, you know, judicial activism, judges coming in at the end and saying things like cruel and unusual punishment, the way in which we can avoid this and still avoid the kind of catastrophe we've been discussing today is to create some courage and some expertise in the executive and legislative branches of state government.
People looking for that on any number of issues. Rob, thanks very much for your call. Good luck. Let's see if we can get one more caller in, and this will be five. Five is Scott. Scott calling us from Salt Lake in Utah.
Yes, Neil, are you there?
I'm there. Go ahead.
Okay. Neil, I am ex-law enforcement, and your guest is right with the discretionary powers. More than once, you find yourself in a situation either someone parking up in the canyons or at a party, two people having consensual sex, teenagers, and you're torn between what the law says and what your conscience is telling you. And, you know, hope I don't get in too much trouble, but I have to admit freely on the air that there were times where it's consensual sex between teenagers, no matter what the ages are. You end up doing a little counseling, you tell, talking with them, explaining what the laws are and what the problem is. And obviously there were times also when you come upon something that it was, you know, it's not consensual sex, and you do have to follow the law to the letter. But it's very, very difficult the way the laws are written and what you actually see. And maybe I was more...
And, Scott, do you understand how it gets even more difficult when it gets to the level... I mean, there's prosecutorial discretion as well. He or she does not have to necessarily bring charges, but it gets more difficult when it becomes that public.
Certainly. And it gets public, and people's names get put in the paper... It is a nightmare for not only the people involved but for their families. And you do. Thank goodness police do have discretionary powers. I'm probably more liberal than most, but it's out there, and people have got to understand. And there has to be laws that present themselves to those situations, as you've been talking about it.
Right.
A gentleman is having sex, a 17-year-old with a 15-year-old, it's consensual sex, but it's also against the law.
Yeah. Scott, thanks very much for your perspective. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can squeeze in one last caller. This is Rob. Rob with us from Kansas.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks.
First of all, I would like to say I'm a fan of the show and a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you for that.
What I like to say is I am a parent. I have four kids, and I just think that the judges should have the leeway based on the totality of the circumstances to make a proper moral and ethical decision based on all that. Also, you know, if both parties are consenting and they're over the age of, I'd say, 16, what's the harm?
Yeah, wherever you draw the line, there's going to be some kid who's 15 and three quarters, and why does it cut off there?
Well, as a parent, I don't know. I would hate to see my kids scarred for the rest of their lives just based on the fact that they made a poor decision one night and pay for it the rest of your life. I have a problem with that. However, there are circumstances where, you know, there has been forcible rape or maybe the child has not... gain the maturity to make a proper decision, and that should be based off of psychological testing and maybe some more investigations on behalf of law enforcement. I don't know.
I think what we're hearing, Frank Zimmering, is people saying there ought to be more leeway for cops, leeway for prosecutors, and for judges as well.
Well, okay. Well, law enforcement.
I just wanted to get a response from our guest.
Well, you can't just give law enforcement the chance to pick the one case in 10,000. That becomes a 10-year mandatory minimum sentence, because that's fundamentally lawless. What you have to do, first of all, is strip away some of the excrescence. Mandatory minimum punishments don't belong. Lifetime registration doesn't belong. Most of this stuff belongs in the juvenile court and belongs on the quiet side. Even if you are going to be using the criminal law here, you have to use it quietly and carefully. And if instead what you're having is a penal lottery in which one loser goes up for 10 years for doing what 30 and 40 and 50% of the kids who went to high school with them does as well, then it's not there's no way in which the exercise of individual discretion can repair the system. It's broken.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And we'd like to thank Frank Zimmering, a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley, for his time today. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
When we come back, the battle shifts to the Manchester Cathedral.